From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, novelist Philip Roth. He's just completed a trilogy that explores how political and social events affect the lives of individuals. I Married a Communist is set in the McCarthy era. American Pastoral, which won a Pulitzer Prize, is set during the war in Vietnam. The new novel, The Human Stain, is about life in the age of political correctness. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews A Time to Be in Earnest, the new autobiography by British mystery writer P.D. James. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in the Philippines have arrested a bank employee and named his girlfriend as a suspect in connection with the Love Bug computer virus. Filipino police and American FBI agents raided the Manila apartment where the man lived with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's sister, seizing computer equipment. Relatives of the man arrested say the real blame may lie with the girlfriend's sister, who recently attended a computer college in Manila. As computer experts struggle to repair the damage from the virus, Lloyd's of London says e-commerce will be the single biggest insurance risk this century. NPR's Snigdha Prakash reports.
From Fidelity to Ford, the love bug has shut down the electronic highway businesses and consumers take for granted these days. No wonder, then, that 70% of U.S. insurance workers surveyed by Lloyd's last week said e-commerce is the biggest emerging insurance risk. Damages from Lovebug, however, are mostly uninsured. The consulting firm Computer Economics of Carlsbad, California, says the economic impact of the bug could climb to $10 billion by Wednesday. By Sunday night, it was already $5 billion. That number includes losses incurred by governments around the world and by businesses when they were struck by the virus or shut down their email servers to protect themselves from it. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
About 3,500 people turned out today for the funeral of Cardinal John O'Connor. The mourners at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City included President and Mrs. Clinton, as well as Mrs. Clinton's Senate rival, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. O'Connor, whose archdiocese served 2.4 million New York Roman Catholics, was known for his religious conservatism and his close ties to Pope John Paul II. According to a conservative legal group, President Clinton told the Arkansas Supreme Court that his testimony in the Monica Lewinsky case was not false. The president is trying to hold on to his legal license. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
The Southeastern Legal Foundation is seeking to have the president's law license revoked, and the revelations today are part of that filing. The group claims that in the president's 85-page argument before the Arkansas Supreme Court, Mr. Clinton states that his testimony was not false as he defines that term, and so the court should not revoke his license. The president's filing is still secret, and his lawyer has declined to release it. The Southeastern Legal Foundation counters that any conduct that involves fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation is grounds for disbarment. The group points to a ruling by a federal judge last year. Judge Susan Weber Wright found the president in contempt of court for lying under oath about his relationship with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow gained 26 points today to close at 10,603 in active trading. This is NPR. New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson has declared a state of emergency in his state because of wildfires burning out of control in two counties. Paul Ingalls reports from member station KUNM in Albuquerque.
Fires are still burning out of control in southern New Mexico near Ruidoso and in northern New Mexico near Los Alamos, home of the Los Alamos National Nuclear Laboratory. Firefighters working the Los Alamos blaze have had the advantage of overcast skies, which have brought humidity levels up a bit, and so far there are no reports of the blaze reaching lab property. Nor have there been any more evacuations beyond the 500 or so residents ordered to leave their homes late Sunday. The fire in Lincoln County to the south is proving a bit harder to handle, as it's been sunny, dry, and windy there. A spokesperson says a mobile home and a couple of home construction sites were destroyed Sunday night after about 150 people were evacuated from five subdivisions. Governor Johnson flew over the Lincoln County fire site today. His state of emergency declaration clears the way for state and federal funds to reimburse local governments for fire costs. For NPR News, I'm Paul Ingalls in Albuquerque.
The Navy says its warplanes resumed training at the bombing range on Puerto Rico's Vieques Island today using dummy bombs. The training started up just days after federal agents removed more than 200 protesters from the site. A Navy spokesman said agents detained 6 more people over the weekend and 2 more today. He said the Navy planes fired non-explosive ordnance at the range in accordance with an agreement made between President Clinton and Puerto Rico's governor in January. Opponents of the range say it endangers people who live on the island and has damaged the environment. In stocks, the Nasdaq lost 147 points today in light trading. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Philip Roth first became known in the late 50s and 60s for writing a new kind of story of Jewish identity. In books like Portnoy's Complaint and Goodbye Columbus, he wrote comically about young Jewish men who were alienated from their culture and families. He's just completed a trilogy that not only explores personal identity, but looks at how larger political and cultural events affect the lives of individuals. American Pastoral, which won a Pulitzer Prize, is about the father of a radical activist opposed to the war in Vietnam. I Married a Communist is set in the McCarthy era. The new novel, The Human Stain, is about life in the age of political correctness. The main character, Coleman Silk, is a classics professor at a small liberal arts college who was forced out after using a word that is misinterpreted as a racial slur. A little later in the story, we learn his secret, which reveals the paradox of his situation. Although everyone believes he is Jewish, he is really a light-skinned African-American who pretended to be Jewish after deciding to pass as a white man. I asked Roth to read a scene in which Silk remembers the emotional impact of telling his mother that he was going to pass and disassociate himself from his black family.
He was murdering her. You don't have to murder your father. The world will do that for you. There are plenty of forces out to get your father. The world will take care of him, as it had indeed taken care of Mr. Silk. Who there is to murder is the mother, and that's what he saw he was doing to her, the boy who'd been loved as he'd been loved by this woman. Murdering her on behalf of his exhilarating notion of freedom. It would have been much easier without her. But only through this test can he be the man he has chosen to be, unalterably separated from what he was handed at birth, free to struggle at being free like any human being would wish to be free. To get that from life, the alternate destiny, on one's own terms, he must do what must be done. Don't most people want to walk out of the lives they've been handed? But they don't, and that's what makes them them. And this was what was making him him. Throw the punch, do the damage, and forever lock the door. You can't do this to a wonderful mother who loves you unconditionally and has made you happy. You can't inflict this pain and then think you can go back on it. It's so awful that all you can do is live with it. Once you've done a thing like this, you have done so much violence, it can never be undone. Which is what Coleman wants.
That's Philip Roth reading from his new novel, The Human Stain. Most of your main characters have been Jewish, and some of them have felt kind of choked by Jewish culture. The idea of writing a character who's African-American trying to pass as Jewish, how did that come to you for the novel?
It's a long process, which is hard for me to recapitulate. And it's hard to remember, especially months after you finished a book, it's hard to remember all the strands that went into the inspiration. However it came to me, I was certainly made nervous by the notion. I wasn't delighted to have had this idea in the beginning.
What was the problem?
What do you think the problem was? I was going to write about a black man. Not only a black man, but I was going to write about a black man who becomes a white man. It was a kind of daunting notion, but one sits down and one applies oneself to it. But it turned out I wasn't as ignorant as I thought I was, And after a while, I hit it. In fact, the very scene I just read, the scene in which Coleman repudiates his mother, this marvelous mother he's had, I think it was in writing that scene that I came to grips with the man. And I'd say the reason I came to grips with him, or how I came to grips with him, was because I ceased defending him. I let the brutality of the act come through. I understood, I myself, as the writer, came to understand the brutality that such a choice entailed. And I think I was able to dramatize fully, vividly, the nature of that brutality by having this scene in which he repudiates his mother's love. And the brutality registers on her, and he sees it registering on her right before his eyes. So he's fully conscious, Coleman, of what he's doing. And as much as this character, I think, has a kind of dignity, I think his dignity arises from the fact that he's never deluded about the price others may pay for what he's doing. And he faces as well the price that he pays. I suppose his dignity or his integrity or even his heroism comes from his consciousness of what he's doing.
Now, the character of Coleman Silk, the African-American professor whose passing is white, is also a victim of political correctness. He calls two students who have never come to class spooks. He says, does anyone know these people? Do they exist? Or are they spooks? And the two students who have never come to class, it turns out, are African-American, which the professor didn't know. And they, in turn, accuse him of racism, of having referred to them with the racial slur of spooks. And as a result of this, he ends up losing his job. Now, one of the previous books in your trilogy, I Married a Communist, is about how lives are affected by McCarthyism. And I'm wondering if you see political correctness today as a kind of new McCarthyism, is the new ideology of the day, similar to McCarthyism, and how actions and motives can often be misinterpreted, how group thinking can blow things out of proportion, how a life can be ruined as a result.
Mm-hmm. I think what joins those two political moments, the McCarthy moment and the present moment, is what Hawthorne called in The Scarlet Letter the persecuting spirit. My book is set in 1998, a great year for the persecuting spirit, if ever there was one. That was the year in which the presidential impeachment took place and everything surrounding it. What interested me about the inquisition on the college campus that does in Coleman Silk was it seemed to me, the more I thought about it, an extension of the general mood of the Inquisition that had sort of begun to run wild in the public life of the country. To be sure, that also was what was going on during the McCarthy era, which I lived through as a college kid.
I Married a Communist, I think it's Nathan Zuckerman who remarks on the ideologies that fill people's heads and undermine their observation of life. Actually, it might be his teacher who says that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you were ever caught up in an ideology, say as a young man, if it ever seemed like intellectual and romantic to you before you saw beyond the ideology.
I don't think I'm an ideological type. I think it's hard for a novelist, a serious novelist who knows what novel writing is about, to be an ideologue, because the writing fiction is founded in observation. And you can't observe through the opaque presence of an ideology. The ideology observes for you. So I think that writers on the whole tend to be anti-ideological, and that to my mind, novels are assaults on generalizations, not endorsements of generalizations.
have you made, I think the answer to this is going to be yes. have you made,
yeah, I'll say it right now, yes.
Have you made observations as a novelist that you feel you were punished or harshly criticized for writing or speaking?
No, not at all. you have to be specific, I think.
Well, I was thinking...
You have something in mind.
I was thinking of your early literature with Portnoy, when people referred to you as a self-hating Jew and stuff.
Oh, right, right. Oh, yes. Well, sure, I thought that those were vicious, malicious, and stupid epithets to attach to me. Just contrary to all the evidence. So, yeah, I felt assaulted by those kind of stupid generalizations. But there's nothing you can do about the stupid generalizations, really. You can feel wounded by them, and you do. And you can fight them, and you do. But in the end, the world grinds these things out the way they make cornflakes at the Kellogg's plant, you know.
My guest is Philip Roth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Roth. His new novel, The Human Stain, completes a trilogy. Now, in some of your books, your surrogate, your alter ego, is the character of Nathan Zuckerman. And in your latest book, The Human Stain, the professor seeks out Zuckerman so he can tell Zuckerman his story in the hopes that Zuckerman will tell it and set the record straight. Zuckerman is also the scribe for the other two books in your trilogy. Why use him as the narrator? Why not, say, let the main character tell the story? Why not let the professor in The Human Stain just tell his story? Or why not have, like, the omniscient third-person unnamed narrator tell the story? Mm. What narrative problems do you solve by having a Zuckerman be the narrator?
Well, the biggest problem I solve is... nothing stands between me and my spontaneous reaction to the material. That is, this is not, it's not just a cunning strategic process, you know. What you're trying to do when you write is find your freedom as a writer. It's what every writer is trying to find. Maximally deploy your powers. And I just feel this is the way I can maximally deploy my powers. By this point in my career, I should be able to spontaneously land on that voice, which will give me the most verbal freedom, imaginative freedom, and that's what Zuckerman does for me. There's something about his intelligence that awakens mine.
Zuckerman is now, I think, 67 in the latest novel. Is that right? 65.
In this book, I think he's something like 64 or 65.
Yeah, and he's now living as a recluse, living alone in the country and writing. He's had prostate cancer, and the surgery resulted in nerve damage that left him incontinent and unable to have sex. There's a short passage spoken by Zuckerman that I'd like you to read. It's on page 36.
Okay. I want to make clear that it wasn't impotence that led me into a reclusive existence. To the contrary, I'd already been living and writing for some 18 months in my two-room cabin up here in the Berkshires when, following a routine physical exam, I received a preliminary diagnosis of prostate cancer, and a month later, after the follow-up tests, went to Boston for the prostatectomy. My point is that by moving here, I had altered deliberately my relationship to the sexual caterwaul. And not because the exhortations, or for that matter, my erections, had been effectively weakened by time, but because I couldn't meet the costs of its clamoring anymore, could no longer marshal the wit, the strength, the patience, the illusion, the irony, the ardor, the egoism, the resilience, or the toughness, or the shrewdness, or the falseness, the dissembling, the dual being, the erotic professionalism, to deal with its array of misleading and contradictory meanings. As a result, I was able to lessen a little my postoperative shock at the prospect of permanent impotence by remembering that all the surgery had done was to make me hold to a renunciation to which I had already voluntarily submitted.
Philip Roth, I find it so interesting. You know, at the beginning of your career with Portnoy's Complaint, you became an author who became famous for writing a character who was so involved with sexual imagination and sex and very creative approaches to masturbation. And now you followed a different character, the character of Zuckerman, to a point in his life where he is physiologically unable to have sex and emotionally perhaps not that sorry about it. He's tired of what you describe as that erotic professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why you, I realize there might not be an answer to this, but why you wanted to put him in that predicament. Why you wanted to explore that kind of physiologically enforced celibacy.
Right. When I was beginning this book, or not this book, I should actually say go back to American Pastoral, because the history of Zuckerman's sexual retirement, as it were, begins with American Pastoral. At about the time I was writing that book, however many years ago it was, 5 or 6, there seemed to me to be a kind of epidemic of prostate cancer in the circle of men who I was close to. So I knew what men went through when they went through this, and I suppose it's not too remote from what women go through with various gynecological surgeries or with a mastectomy. It's a tremendous blow. It's a very, very difficult operation physically. Forget the consequences of it. And I saw this being enacted in numerous places, and I thought, well, I've reached an age where this is now a kind of phenomenon of my generation, and so I decided to take it seriously. You know, it isn't the plague, but it did seem to me a powerful blight on the sexuality and virility, needless to say, of these men I know. So that's what interested me in it to begin with. Shall I go on, Terry?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm wondering, too, if in following through on that, it made you think in a different way about a certain type of virility, a certain type of almost hyperactive male sexuality.
Well, now we're going to get into who's going to measure what.
Of the show, I'll do the measuring.
What's hyperactive down in Philadelphia, you know, may not be hyperactive in Manhattan.
Right.
I think that a blow of that kind to a virile heterosexual man is brutal. Has nothing to do with hypersexual activity, if I may say so, but to one's sexual identity and to one's sense of physical strength and completeness. It's a serious business. As for hyperactivity, to take seriously what I said jokingly a moment ago, what is hyperactivity? There are no norms. There are no sexual norms that an adult can take seriously. Just think about the history of norms and how cruel they now seem. Think of the norm of heterosexuality as opposed to homosexuality. That was a norm, was it not? And it's no longer a norm. So we don't know what the norms are. It's a very mysterious and enigmatic business, sexual activity. And that's why I've been interested in the sexual lives of men. I'm not out to titillate anybody. I'm out to try to figure out what it is, mm-hmm. and to represent it as best I can.
Now, at the same time, you explore the opposite side, which is that the 71-year-old professor in your novel is taking Viagra and having an affair with a much younger woman, and he thinks that he'd never be able to do this if it wasn't for Viagra. So he has had this kind of sexual resurgence in his 70s.
Well, Viagra seemed to me also a kind of phenomenon that a novelist ought to take seriously and not just have gags about it on late-night television. It's a gigantic social change, like a gigantic moral, the potential of gigantic moral changes in the society. So like prostate cancer, the introduction of this drug in the last 5 years seemed to me to signal a gigantic change in the culture, and therefore it seems to me that's what a novelist is interested in, which is the deep influences that are at work in a country, which determine the mood of the country and determine the lives of people.
There's also a wonderful paragraph that I think I will read about the vulnerability that you expose yourself to in sexual intimacy. And this is said by the African-American professor who's passing as white, and for him, the sexual act kind of exposes him to the possibility of discovery. He says, you take off your clothes and you're in bed with somebody, and that is indeed where whatever you've concealed, your particularity, whatever it may be, however encrypted, is going to be found out. And that's what the shyness is all about and what everybody fears. In that anarchic, crazy place, how much of me is being seen? How much of me is being discovered? I really like that a lot.
Good, good. Well, I'm delighted that you do it. I'm delighted that you read it. This book is about the things we've already talked about, to be sure, the inquisitorial spirit, the persecuting spirit, what's called political correctness, the passing, quote-unquote, of this man from one culture to another. But I also wanted to investigate and represent the power, the transforming power of sex, the transforming power of the erotic. And there's another passage, I don't think I could find it if I'm searching for it now, but when Zuckerman is recounting this sexual reawakening in the 71-year-old man, and he says, who could be against it?
Philip Roth, his new novel is called The Human Stain. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House Incorporated, Bantam Books Division, publisher of Fierce Invalids Home from Hot Climates, the new novel by Tom Robbins. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Jewish Identity and Growing Up American. We continue our conversation with novelist Philip Roth. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new autobiography by British mystery writer P.D. James. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philip Roth. His new novel, The Human Stain, completes his trilogy about the impact of political and social events on the lives of individuals. American Pastoral is about the father of a radical activist who opposes the war in Vietnam. I Married a Communist is set in the McCarthy era. The new novel, The Human Stain, is about life in the age of political correctness. The three novels are narrated by Roth's fictional alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman. Two of the novels in your trilogy are about Zuckerman's boyhood heroes. I Married a Communist, the story revolves around two brothers. One of those brothers was Zuckerman's English teacher when he was in high school. The other is a working man who became a well-known radio drama star and a communist. And about Mr. Ringgold, the English teacher, Nathan Zuckerman says, "Mr. Ringgold taught us thinking is the greatest transgression of all, critical thinking. There is the ultimate subversion. Seeing it demonstrated by him provided the most valuable clue to growing up that I had clutched at as a provincial, protected, high-minded high school kid, yearning to be rational and of consequence and free." Did you have such a teacher who really taught you the value of critical thinking?
I was lucky. I think I had more than one, though one is often enough. And I think that most sort of bright American kids are fortunate enough usually along the way to run into that man or woman who teaches you to think. It's kind of an amazing thing, isn't it? I fell under the influence of some people, largely in college, more in college than in high school. I don't really think I knew how to think in high school. Once again, Zuckerman is smarter than I was.
Zuckerman also says he really liked men who could talk about baseball and boxing, and also talk about books as if they really mattered. Did you too, when you were young, wanting to find that combination?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think for American boys, growing up as I did in the 30s and 40s, it was very hard to make the association between one's, and I use this word in its widest sense, one's virility, one's appetite, one's aggression, and learning. And it was certainly very important to make that association, because without it, learning seemed sort of schoolmarmish, you know. So, and that, by the way, I grew up in an era when 95% of the teachers were women. We were little boys raised in schools that were by women. Some of them were quite wonderful teachers. Some of them were just ordinary teachers, of course. But to have a male teacher who brought a certain flavor into the classroom, who was also intellectually demanding. So when he brought the flavor of his masculinity and the sternness of his rigorous mind into the classroom, that was indeed a great blessing. And I do remember a couple such men from my high school years, excluding, say, gym teachers. That was something else.
Who were the people in your life that first exposed you to a life that was different from the life of your parents?
I suppose a couple teachers did. I think that as boys, we brought each other up. I mean, all the circle of friends one had as a kid. I think what happens is the country brings you up in a strange way. Or to put it another way, the culture brings you up. And the richer the culture, the more strains there are in the culture that aren't totally vulgar and stupid, the better educated you get in becoming something new and becoming a new generation. So one's parents give one plenty, but when you leave them, yes, you're perfectly right. You need mentors. And I would again say I think there's something in the larger society that educates you. And then there is the circle of one's friends, and you educate each other and you evolve into a new human, a new social or cultural type through this sort of effort, a kind of team effort almost.
Newark, New Jersey plays a big part in your trilogy. You grew up in Newark. What was your immediate neighborhood, your immediate culture like when you were growing up?
And well, I was born in 33, and so I guess by about 43, I was my eyes were open, and the war was on, World War II. And that was an overwhelming experience, though needless to say the war was not fought here, but the whole country was at war, and the mood of the country was determined totally by the war. And I felt that mood in our neighborhood, as everywhere else. My neighborhood was really a kind of Jewish village, I would say, in a city that was made up of ethnic villages. So the word ethnic did not exist. We never thought of ourselves that way. I think ethnic is a word that comes out of the 60s, really. I mean, it existed, but it was not a word that we used to describe ourselves. And so I never thought of myself, by the way, as an American Jew. I think of myself as an American or a Jewish American. These terms are utterly foreign to me. I never felt that anything but amused by designation. But you can call me a Newark Jew if you want to. There were Newark Italians, there were Newark Poles, there were Newark Irish. I think as kids we experienced these differences locally in the city because we lived in neighborhoods that were defined in that way. And there was a certain amount of xenophobia. There was a certain amount of hostility. But once one left the neighborhood, one wasn't a Newark Jew, one was an American. So it was a Jewish neighborhood, Jewish high school, Jewish grade school, Jewish high school, Jews everywhere. Strangely, I was thinking the other day, I never saw a Jew in a skull cap on the street in my life growing up. Someone asked me about that recently. Did I wear a skull cap as a kid? I said, outrageous. I wouldn't have thought of such a thing. Nor did anybody else in the neighborhood. So here was this 100% Jewish neighborhood, and I didn't know a single soul to wear a skull cap, which tells you a lot about the fierce secularization, the fierce Americanization of my generation and my parents' generation.
My guest is Philip Roth. His new novel is called The Human Stain. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Roth. Like most novelists, he has drawn on his life for his fiction. He was written about, often in an unflattering way, in a 1996 memoir by his ex-wife, the actress Claire Bloom. But that's a subject he declines to talk about. This is a quote that you said back in 1987 that was published in U.S. News and World Report. You said, "I wouldn't want to live with a novelist. Writers are highly voyeuristic and indiscreet. But the writer should be no more ruthless with others than with himself. The same intensity of focus should be turned inward as outward." Do you feel that friends of yours have ever felt betrayed by you as a writer because you've tried to be honest? And we all have secrets. And we don't want to be honest about our secrets. We want to be secretive about our secrets.
Let me counter with an anecdote about Czeslaw Milosz, who won the Nobel Prize for Poetry, I guess, about 10 years ago. Milosz was asked a similar question. I'll tell you what he said. He was asked about, because he also writes prose and he's written memoirs and so on. He was asked about the relationship between a writer and his family and about this issue of revealing secrets and betrayal. And Milosz said, "When a writer is born into a family, the family is finished." So the defense rests.
Is that tough to live with?
For the others?
For you, the writer, who in being honest in your own way betrays the others.
I don't know if it has so much to do with being honest. You give us too much credit. I think it's just fascination. There's no novelist worth his or her salt who isn't fascinated by the real, and whose job is founded and grounded in this fascination with the real thing. There's an awful lot of stupid, childish awe in writers. People may think that you're trying to reveal their secrets. You're sort of dumbstruck by their secrets, and by your own, of course, too. And there's far less vindictiveness than is imagined on the part of the writer who writes about somebody's secret than just this sort of stupid, childish awe of the human fact of it. So it isn't so much that one is pious about oneself or pious about being a writer and say, well, I have to be honest. It's not that at all. It's you're hypnotized, you're mesmerized, you're fascinated by the thing in itself, and you want to present it. Now, other people may see it otherwise. They get hurt, I guess.
Are there writers who you read or who you've known who, as a young writer, gave you permission to write like yourself instead of trying to write like the people you most admired of other generations or other eras?
Sure. I have a great debt to several people. I suppose my largest debt would be to Bello, to Saul Bello. And I'm not alone in that, by the way. And you don't have to be Jewish to be indebted to Saul Bello either. I suspect that half a dozen of my colleagues of my generation are a little younger, a little younger, I would say, had their eyes opened to literary freedom by Bello, particularly by a book that appeared in 1954, The Adventures of Augie March. One doesn't write like Bello, as you say, as you suggest, one doesn't write like Bello as a result. And it isn't that you then imitate this person. They provide you with a kind of example of freedom. Just as a youngster growing up may admire some older kid, because of his or her freedom. I think we all have had that experience. Likewise with a writer, you feel not just the freedom, but the energy, and needless to say, the genius. Without the genius, none of these things mean anything. But this genius has a kind of freedom which inspires you. The opening line of Augie March is rather famous, or was then. Nothing in literature is famous any longer. But the opening line is of Bello's book is, I am an American Chicago born. What's interesting is that it doesn't begin, I'm an American Jew Chicago born, or I'm an American born a Jew in Chicago. Bello, in a single sentence, freed a whole generation of Jewish writers who came after him to write of the thing which was so powerful in their lives, which was their Americanness. Now, that I'm just speaking just thematically of his importance. We can also speak of his verbal freedom, too, which was equally inspiring.
Philip Roth is my guest. Within the past decade or a little more than that, you've had bypass surgery and also suffered a bad depression. I think for a lot of people, when you go through something that's very kind of physically life-changing, you look around at the rest of your life and figure, well, what else do I want to change? Did you make big changes in your life after that?
Let me think. I had quintuple bypass surgery back in 1989. It's now 11 years. It was kind of out of the blue, and all I knew is I was swimming in my pool one day, and the next day I was having an operation. And I was exhilarated by the operation. First of all, they'd saved my life. Very exhilarating, that is. And I walked around exhilarated for about 6 months. And I think it re-energized me strangely. I did have a brutal depression in 7 or 8 years ago. And gee, all you want to do is climb out of the hole, you know, and you're so content. You're in a deep hole and there are no rungs on the side to climb out with. And it's a terrible experience. It descends almost like the other thing out of the blue. And you think you'll never get out. You feel like you're in a straitjacket, except it's a mental straitjacket. And somehow you fight your way out. And after that, I think, I don't know. I don't know, Terry, if I could really say that I decided I would live differently. You've just been through the damn ringer, that's all. And you're glad to have survived. And you just want to go on. You just want to go on.
Did it leave you any more or less of a believer in either pharmaceutical therapy or talk therapy for, you know, a really brutal depression?
I don't know that talk therapy helps. It's nice to have sympathetic friends. That is a help. As far as professional talk, I don't know that if you've had the real thing that matters. The drugs are great. These Prozac and those things. They can get you out of it, and which is better than the old days. You know, 25, 30 years ago, people just sort of sat around with these things, and it was pretty grim. It's pretty grim altogether. My advice is not to have it.
Thanks. We'll do our best. In American Pastoral, Nathan Zuckerman says about the character whose story he's telling, he had learned the worst lesson that life can teach, that it makes no sense. Do you feel that that's the lesson of life, or that that's only the lesson of life when you're going through a really bad depression?
That line that you read is a telling one, to be sure, but it's not about a character who's in depression. It's about Swede Lvov after his daughter blows up a building to protest the Vietnam War.
Right.
And his life is ruined as though she'd set the bomb off not at the local post office but in their living room. I was talking about a life that's overtaken by what I call elsewhere the uncontrollability of real things, and I wasn't speaking then about depression.
Right. Is that, do you feel like, life's lesson, or that only some people are stuck in that predicament that life seems to make no sense?
I suppose everybody has those minutes, hours, days when it seems to make no sense. You're blessed if you can escape those feelings. I think it makes no sense, but you have to believe otherwise.
You think life makes no sense?
Not to me it doesn't, but I pretend it does.
And maybe try to give it sense in novels, or explore the no sense that it seems to have.
Both. Yes, quite seriously, both. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Philip Roth's new novel is called The Human Stain. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new autobiography by British mystery writer P.D. James. This is Fresh Air. Mystery writer P.D. James has a new autobiography. It's called A Time to Be in Earnest. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says the memoir doesn't solve all the mysteries of James' life, but it will deepen her readers' appreciation of the woman considered by many to be the greatest living writer of detective fiction.
Reading this diary of a year in the life of mystery master P.D. James will no doubt make her legions of devoted fans, of which I am one, want to give her a good throttling. "Stay home," I hissed in exasperation about halfway through A Time to Be in Earnest. "Sit still at your desk for a few days and begin a new novel." For if we learn one thing about James in this memoir, it's that she doesn't like to stay put. Like some hardy Victorian lady explorer whose carpet bag is always packed and ready, James is an enthusiastic party-goer, lecturer, and junketeer. In the course of a few short weeks, she trundles off to Norway, jets off on an American book tour that includes one-night stands in Pittsburgh and Dayton, and gamely goes to sea on the QE2 as a guest speaker. This dizzying schedule barely leaves James time for socializing with her two daughters and their families, or with her fellow mystery writer pals like Dick Francis, Ruth Rendell, and John Mortimer. Like most English ladies of a certain age, James fixates in her diary on flowers, ecclesiastical architecture, and her cat. But strangely, about the act of writing, we hear nary a mention. Perhaps this is just as well. Writing can be a frustrating and messy enterprise. To read a diary entry by James that confessed something like, "Saturday, 16 June, sat at my desk for hours, scratching my forehead and watching dandruff motes drift by in the sunlight," well, that would spoil the atmosphere of competent good cheer this diary radiates. Despite, or perhaps because of this book's unprepossessing subtitle, A Fragment of Autobiography implicitly warns readers not to expect too much. James's diary is very entertaining and very calming, like reading a Barbara Pym novel about English gentlewomen. In her prologue, James says that one of her motives for undertaking this record of 1 year, from her 77th to 78th birthday, was to have her own say on her life before posthumous biographers began feasting on it. In these entries, James reveals herself to be resolutely unself-pitying, kind, there's no dirt dished here, and socially conservative. For example, James tells a feminist lawyer she meets at a literary dinner that she's tired of women presenting themselves as victims. Because, as James admits at the outset, her diary will inevitably catch on the threads of memory as burrs stick to a coat. We hear about her parents and their melancholy marriage, her traditional schooling, where the curriculum was heavy on the memorization of poetry, which James thinks was a good thing, her career as a civil servant in various government offices, her belated start as a detective fiction writer, and her musings on why women are particularly suited for the literary art of murder. Even in an autobiographical fragment like this one, however, themes inevitably emerge, themes that James herself seems largely unaware of. She makes constant references here to the wars that transformed her world. Reflecting on World War I, James eloquently states, "My generation was born under a pall of inarticulate grieving." James gave birth to her second daughter as German buzz bombs were raining down outside the hospital. She writes of the daily deprivations and culinary horrors of wartime as vividly as she describes the workings of Adam Dalgliesh's overactive brain in her extraordinary mystery series. James also returns over and over to the enduring loss that World War II inflicted on her life. In the very first entry here, she describes a dismal railway ride back from a weekend at a seaside hotel where she attended a golden wedding anniversary party for Dick Francis and his wife. That initial image of a solitary James standing apart and observing other people's apparently happy marriages is one that reoccurs throughout this diary. James's own marriage was terribly diminished when her young husband, Connor, returned from World War II a different man, one who would suffer from mental illness and be in and out of asylums until his death in the early 1960s at the age of 44. About him, James simply states, "I shan't write about my marriage in this incomplete diary, except to say that I have never found, or indeed looked for, anyone else with whom I have wanted to spend the rest of my life." Nonetheless, her husband, or his absence, haunts these pages. It's glib to say, but maybe his absence has enabled them to be written too. The tragedy of her husband's death seems to have placed a pane of glass between James and the world she observes. And her characteristic stance, James's way of talking about herself as being apart, even in the midst of the most congenial crowd, is, after all, the quintessential writer's position. James's title comes courtesy of Dr. Johnson. At 77, it is time to be in earnest. Judging by her own no-nonsense account of her industrious and thoughtful life, there never seems to have been a time when James wasn't.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Time to Be in Earnest, a fragment of autobiography by P.D. James. Fresh Air senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. Anne Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope, by Jonathan Kozol. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our TV critic David Bianculli speaks with the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Joss Whedon. He's the executive producer and writer for Buffy and its spin-off, Angel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.